Good morning. My name is Anastasia, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Littler's Workplace Policy Institute conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and an operator will come back to assist you. Thank you. Ms. Eileen Schuman, you may begin your conference.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Eileen Schuman and I'm co-chair of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute. And thank you for joining us on the Insider Briefing call this morning. The U.S. Senate is poised to vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act this week. And our special guest today is Josh Rothman, shareholder in Littler's Northern Virginia office. Josh is the managing shareholder of Littler's East Coast OFCCP unit. Josh is also an expert on compensation and specifically the Equal Pay Act, which brings us to our issue of the day. Josh, welcome to the Insider Briefing. Gender pay equity has been at the heart of President Obama's Opportunity for All agenda, and we have some breaking news this morning. President Obama will sign two new executive actions on equal pay at the White House on Tuesday. Josh, can you tell us about these two executive orders coming tomorrow?
Sure. So, you know, those of you who have been following legal developments and those of you who are federal contractors specifically know that a lot of the ways that some of the policy initiatives of the administration are coming through are through executive orders specifically on federal contractors, and that's because obviously Congress is controlled by the other party than the White House. And so we had one on a minimum wage requirements for federal contractors several weeks ago, and now there are going to be two more coming out tomorrow. And obviously those have not been published yet, so we don't know all the details, but what the gist of the two of them are is one is going to prohibit contractors from retaliating against workers when they discuss their salaries with one another. And then the other one, and this is actually an initiative that OFCCP has had on their regulatory agenda for a while anyways, but the executive order will now specifically instruct the Secretary of Labor to create regulations requiring federal contractors to report summary compensation data broken down by gender and by race, ethnicity. And that's not a new initiative with DOL, but now the White House is basically going to formally say, DOL, please issue these regulations.
Well, Josh, gender pay equity is also at the center of the expected vote this week in the Senate on the Paycheck Fairness Act. At the Senate hearing last week, Senator Elizabeth Warren said that she can't believe we're debating pay equity in 2014. Is gender pay equity illegal?
Well, certainly there's several laws that protect pay equity by gender and by race and ethnicity as well. Most notably would be Title VII through the very well-known Lilly Ledbetter Pay Act, which was passed. It was actually the first law the president signed. So we have that. Federal contractors are very closely scrutinized on their pay practices through the enforcement of the Department of Labor and the requirements of Executive Order 11246. And then, of course, there is the Equal Pay Act, which the Paycheck Fairness Act would amend, which already exists, which also protects pay disparities that can't be, you know, that are due to gender. So those are the laws that are on the books today.
And so what exactly would the Paycheck Fairness Act do?
Sure. The Paycheck Fairness Act is going to would do a few things. One thing is the employer defense to differences in pay would have to be job-related and consistent with business necessity, which is a concept which comes from adverse impact case law, even though the Equal Pay Act is not an adverse impact law but a disparate treatment law. So we're sort of applying a concept that's relevant in disparate impact law to disparate treatment law, which is why it's controversial. But probably more controversial is the fact that even if they do that, an employee can point to any alternative that achieves the same business end, and if they can, they win the case. And there's nothing, the word reasonable isn't in the statute. It doesn't have to be a reasonable alternative. And so that's the part that's a sort of, I think, concerning to employers, is the fact that an employee can say, no, you can do this instead. And if they do that, and what's going to be the acceptable alternatives, and there's nothing that sort of reins that in, and I think that's what's a little bit unsettling. A couple of other things it does, it's going to have unlimited, potentially punitive and compensatory damages, and also it's going to enhance the class type of litigation people bring, so it would have an opt-out. So basically, you're in the class unless you specifically say you're not. This is all going to make this a very attractive vehicle for plaintiffs attorneys to bring cases, to look for cases to bring, because they can get these large amount of damages, and the employees have this trump card, if you will, over the employer defense, that is, we have an alternative that's better. And so that's frightening to most employers, because basically the employee's judgment could replace their judgment on what's job-related and consistent business necessity and what's the best way of achieving it. In addition, it has a few other things. There's provisions about employees not being retaliated against for sharing their compensation information. It calls for similar to actually what this executive order is going to do, pay collection by the Department of Labor. Interesting, one of the things it wants to actually collect the data by is by pay grade. It says they should not look at it by pay grade, but pay grades, companies don't set those because it's saying these people should be the same. It's generally a loose thing that employers develop about people they think market-wise belong in the same place, but saying everyone in the pay grade should be paid the same, that's not what employers do, and yet we're going to go backwards about 15 to 20 years in how we've thought about looking at pay by saying, yeah, let's go back to looking things at pay grade again, which the Department of Labor realized probably a good 15 or 20 years ago that was not a good way to look at things. So there's a lot of controversial things in it, but I think that the biggest one is probably the trump card, if you will, and then making it available for these class action vehicles as well.
Well, thanks, Josh. At the Senate hearing last week, proponents of the Paycheck Fairness Act said the bill is needed because employers are retaliating against employees who disclose their colleagues' wages. What are your concerns with making compensation information public?
Yeah, I think there's basically two major concerns driving it, and one of them is actually a concern for employees themselves, that most or a lot of people, and I would say probably most people, are very private about what they're making. They don't want other people to know what their compensation is. They're uncomfortable with that idea, and I think the employer community's sensitivity to this issue is coming from the sensitivity about how their sense is, and I think they're right about this, about how most of their employees feel about sharing what they're being paid with everyone else. And then the other one I would say is competitive interests, that, you know, employers are very protective about not letting their competitors know exactly what they're paying people and what their competitors need to do to steal their employees away and things like that. So I think those are the two primary things driving it. But, you know, interestingly, the main driver probably is that they're a concern that many employees don't want their compensation information shared. So it's not just because that the employers don't want it for their own sake, but how they think their employees will feel about that, that I think is a big part of the concern.
Well, Josh, the Paycheck Fairness Bill would provide unlimited compensatory and punitive damages to the Equal Pay Act. This would have an enormous impact on employers. Can you discuss some of the implications of allowing unlimited compensatory and punitive damages in employment law claims?
Yeah, this is a total game changer and it doesn't exist in any other employment law that's out there. And there's also no parameters within the law itself that what would be the situation that drives compensatory or punitive damage. It doesn't say it has to be intentional. There's no rhetoric within the law itself that says these are cases that get compensatory and punitives and these are ones that don't. And I think that's very troubling because then, you know, what degree does it have to be willful? There's no language like that right now for it. And then the idea that it's unlimited is pretty scary because there's no predictability about how these cases will play out. Again, it's going to be very attractive to plaintiff's attorneys. And I will add one point when we're talking about class stuff and trying to make conclusions about pay discrimination with a broad brush. As I at least mentioned at the beginning of the call, my primary area of practicing is with federal contractors and with the Department of Labor's OFCCP. And compensation, as those of you on the call of federal contractors know, is a huge part of what OFCCP is scrutinizing and audits. And what we're seeing anecdotally is that when you look at people in the same job and you roll your sleeves up and figure out what's driving what the people are paying, that it's employers are able to explain it. But most of the things that sort of close that loop are things that are pretty fact-specific and almost impossible to quantify. You know, the fact that one person may have if you're in IT, one person may know three different coding languages, another person may know five, and then the one person knows this one critical coding language that the other person knows, how do you get that into some equation or into a class-type claim? And these sort of fact-specific things are really important to understanding what's really going on here. And yet when you go with these big classes, you have to paint things with a broad brush, which doesn't allow you to get into the details of what's really going on. That's when we see these data points like 78 cents on the dollar. Even those own studies show when you take into account for things like experience, et cetera, it gets much smaller than that. And then even those studies are clearly leaving out relevant factors. And so while anecdotally, I think, or intuitively, it seems to all of us there's some pay gap there, I don't think we really know what the percentage is that's unexplained. It's certainly less than 78, which isn't even making an honest attempt to get around the issue. The closer ones have it somewhere in the 90s. And then the question is that remaining gap, how much can it be explained? And is it even discernible in individual employer decisions? And what we're seeing dealing with these a lot on individual employer bases and OFCCP audits is that it's actually not seeing it a lot. And in fact, OFCCP's own audit record is showing that OFCCP has been auditing compensation very closely since actually the George W. Bush administration, even before that. But this has been a top priority for the agency for quite some time, and what we're seeing is they're not finding problems. You can probably count on one hand, certainly not more than two hands, the number of cases where OCCP has found a problem with how companies are paying people, and yet they've done between 3,500 and 5,000 audits a year, and that's all they're finding. So anecdotally, we're not seeing it in individual employer decisions.
Thank you, Josh. And turning to the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which is now 5 years old, how have you seen that law operate in practice in the last 5 years?
Yeah, and that's actually similar to the point I was just making about when the OFCCP world. So we had this new law, which obviously was very heavily publicized. As I mentioned earlier, it was the first law that President Obama signed, and yet we're not seeing a lot of cases under it. We're not seeing a lot of successful cases on it. And while the advocates of the Paycheck Fairness Act say that's the reason why we need the Paycheck Fairness Act, I think there's an equally compelling point of view that says, well, the reason we're not seeing it is because the problem, which I don't think is zero, is being vastly overstated. And, you know, I think any of us who know how Washington works knows that good politics will always trump good policy. And so there may be less than entirely 100% good insight into what the real issue is because, you know, but, and both parties do it, good politics, you know, tends to trump good policy in Washington, and it's one of the unfortunate things with, you know, the way the system's worked lately, and, it is what it is.
Well, thank you, Josh. And finally, as you said, your primary focus is on compliance with OFCCP requirements for federal contractors. What else are you seeing in your experience in employer compensation audit?
Yeah, and, this was mentioned earlier, but what we're seeing is employers are able to explain why they're paying people. But I think the more important point, and this goes back to why there's controversy over Paycheck Fairness Act and the class perspective, and also these data collections, which are going to be, again, on the back of contractors. What we're seeing is OCCP is spending a lot of time, and employers are spending a lot of resources having to explain why they're paying people the way they're paying people. That probably takes more time than any other part of an OFCCP audit. These are resources that the company is taking out that they have to spend with their HR people and their compensation people and their managers trying to explain why it is that their employees are paying what they're doing. The good news is they're able to do it. And that's good news for another reason, for many reasons. One is, you know, that's good to know. But from a policy perspective, I'm glad we're not seeing a great problem. I mean, that's a good thing. But unfortunately, it means it's a cost to contractors, and yet we're having more laws passed that are going to make the cost of sort of explaining this more and more and more and more, that the anecdotally what we're seeing is when you really roll up your sleeves and try to get underneath the problem, it's not thankfully, it's not nearly as big a problem as often the political rhetoric makes it seem.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for your very timely and insightful comments today. Also with us is Michael Lehman, who is the manager of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute. Michael previously led the Employer Coalition here in Washington on the Paycheck Fairness Act. What are the prospects for the Paycheck Fairness Act this year and this week?
Sure. Well, the Paycheck Fairness Act isn't becoming law this year. Everyone's calling this a show vote in the Senate this week because it won't pass the House anytime soon, certainly not this year. But after all, 2014 is a midterm congressional election year. But whether the vote this week is a meaningless exercise or not, the Paycheck Fairness Bill remains one of these bills that will become law someday in all likelihood when the political makeup of the Congress and the White House is supportive of the bill. I mean, the Paycheck Fairness Bill came within two Senate votes of becoming law back in 2010. as recently as 2010, I should say. So it's important for employers and human resource professionals to be aware of this proposal. And, of course, through the executive order that Josh has discussed coming out tomorrow, we may see provisions of the paycheck bill be imposed on federal contractors through the executive branch. But as far as legislative prospects this year, the last vote on the paycheck fairness bill in the Senate was in 2012, and that vote was a completely party line vote of 52-47. 60 votes were needed to surpass a filibuster, as always in the Senate. So there are 55 Democrats in the Senate today, so the vote will be very close to 55 votes in support, 45 votes opposed. So, but this is a bill that isn't going away anytime soon. And at this point, I'll wrap it up. And again, want to thank Josh Rothman very much for joining us today. Here are some things to be aware of this week, everybody. In addition to the federal contractor executive order coming out tomorrow, the House and Senate are in session for one more week this week ahead of the 2-week Easter Passover congressional work break that begins next week. The House will vote on its fiscal year 2015 budget resolution this week, and on Wednesday morning, the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Primary Health and Aging will hold a hearing on primary care and the workforce. So if you have any questions about tomorrow's executive order or the OFCCP or other issues, contact me or Josh Rothman, and we can connect you with Josh or another subject matter expert here at Littler. Thanks, everybody, for joining this week's Insider Briefing. We'll see you next Monday morning at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Have a great week.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.